Hello and welcome to NewsHour. We're coming to you live with Rebecca Kesby in London and me, James Kamarasamy, in Berlin. I'm in the German capital on an evening when the political pendulum in Europe's largest economy has swung decisively from left to right. This broadcast position is looking out over the Brandenburg Gate, a monument often illuminated in the colours of a country's flag to show solidarity in moments of tragedy. Tonight, we don't know which combination of political colours will enter the next German government, but we do know who will lead it, Friedrich Merz of the centre-right Christian Democrats. According to the latest vote projections from today's general election, Mr. Merz's party, together with its Bavarian sister party, the CSU, is expected to get around 28.5% of the vote. In second place, currently with a historically high result of 20.5%, the far-right AfD. The big losers, the Social Democrats, or SPD, of the outgoing Chancellor Olaf Scholz. 3 months after his fractious coalition collapsed, his party's vote went the same way today, down by 10 points from 4 years ago. The SPD's worst ever post-war result, and not one that Mr. Scholz could sugarcoat.
This is a bitter election result for the SDP. It is an election defeat. I think that must be stated clearly and unambiguously at the outset. For me, it is also very important to say that this is a result from which we must move forward together.
Shunned by Germany's traditional parties, but supported by a fifth of the German electorate, the AfD are now clearly the main opposition. The CDU reiterated tonight that it will not enter into coalition with a party whose anti-immigration platform has traditionally been considered too extreme for government. But that will have come as no surprise to a triumphant-sounding AfD leader, Alice Weidel.
Wir haben ein historisches Ergebnis.
We have achieved a historic result. We've never been stronger in government. We've become the second strongest force of the Alternative for Germany, and we've now firmly established ourselves as a people's party.
Well, Friedrich Merz has played the long political game, losing the CDU leadership battle to Angela Merkel more than 20 years ago and then taking a few goes to grab the crown when he finally swapped a high-paying private sector career for a second high-stakes political one. But the man who will be the next German chancellor told his supporters tonight that he'll be showing urgency in his attempt to form a workable coalition.
Now we will talk to each other, and the main thing is to re-establish a government in Germany that is capable of acting as quickly as possible with a good parliamentary majority. Because, dear friends, the world out there is not waiting for us, and it is not waiting for lengthy coalition talks and negotiations.
Well, let's speak now to the BBC's Jessica Parker, who's at the headquarters of the Christian Democrats. What's the mood been like there tonight, Jess?
Yeah, well, I don't know if you can hear, just in the room beyond where I am at the moment, there is some loud music playing, a band going, people are drinking beer and sipping German sparkling wine. So in that way, it's pretty cheery. And when those exit polls first dropped, there were cheers and applause. But I think there is also a bit of disappointment that they don't seem to have done better than the exit polls are so far suggesting. I think there have been hopes of being at 30 or above 30%. So a little bit of disappointment there. But also, you know, they are a party that looks like it will now lead the next coalition government. So in that sense, they're cheerful.
But unclear at this point whether that coalition will be a two-party one or will have to involve three parties.
Yeah, Mr. Merz, Friedrich Merz, the leader of the CDU, very clear he wants it to be a two-party coalition for the obvious reason that it's much easier to negotiate a coalition deal and then govern the country. And we've seen that because of Olaf Scholz's three-way coalition, which, of course, collapsed. What we're looking out for now is whether these smaller parties actually make it into the Bundestag. So Sarawagen Connects, BSV, the FDP as well, they look like they may well crash out because you have to reach this 5% threshold. So I think people waiting to see how those numbers shake down, because if they don't make it in, then the seats kind of formations change. So all eyes on those numbers overnight, and Friedrich Merz will then want to get to work with those negotiations.
Yeah, very briefly, a sizable AfD vote. You mentioned some of the other parties. The parties on the populist left have also done perhaps better than expected. What does it all tell us, do you think?
Mm. Yeah, Die Linke having a bit of a late surge there, the left party. Definitely people I speak to, and the results bear this out, suggest that more people are moving to the left or to the right. Certainly people I've spoken to suggest that they've seen that within their friendship groups as well. But for Alternative for Deutschland, practically doubling their result from the last election. So they're pretty ecstatic in that sense. But as you were mentioning, they won't get into power because other parties won't work with them. But they're seeing this as a stepping stone to the next election. They certainly have their eye on 2029.
Jess, many thanks. Jess Parker there at the Christian Democrats headquarters. Well, let's speak to that party's foreign affairs spokesman, Jürgen Hart, who joins us now. Good evening, Mr. Hart. You didn't make 30%, it would appear. So perhaps you haven't quite lived up to what your expectations might have been.
Yes, hello, Jenny. My expectation was also that we might come out with 30% plus. But it's now looking like 28.6 or 28.7. The big question in German politics now is, does it fit for a two-party coalition, which mean normally looking to CDU, CSU on one side and Social Democrats on the other side? Or do we need a three-party coalition? And unfortunately, there's the Liberals, which fit good to CDU, CSU. They slip out of the parliament, and probably there's only a Green Party for us as a coalition partner, and a coalition between Social Democrats, Greens, and CDU, CSU might be very difficult in some fields. Not in foreign and security policy, but in other fields.
Right. I mean, I know you're going to say this is a non-starter, but surely the German public have told you that the party you should be having a coalition with is the AfD. They are clearly the second largest party in the country.
Mm-hmm. AfD is the trinary course of Russia and German politics. They want to step us out of European Union. They want to step us out of the euro. They want to step us out of NATO. This would be a very big, difficult exercise for Germany to follow them. There's no consensus between Christian Democrats on one side and AfD on the other side in such important fields of where we have to.
Well, there is one field, isn't there, as you showed in Parliament just a few weeks ago on the need to tighten the borders. You did work alongside them. This famous firewall was not as intact as many people thought it was. You have shown you can work with them.
We didn't work with them. It was a situation where AfD announced to put a law on the table that we put into the Deutsche Bundestag on the 9th of September as a concrete reaction on the brutal terror attack in my constituency in Solingen. This draft of a law was rejected in the Home Affairs Committee of the Deutsche Bundestag in November. And due to the fact that the Liberals stepped out of that coalition of Olaf Scholz and moved to us in that question, there was probably close to a majority for that law. But I would not be able to explain to my voters in Solingen that I'm against a law that we put on the table only because the AfD is also in favor of that. This is not a cooperation. This is a parliamentary process.
Okay, well, just briefly then, Jürgen. I mean, on the big questions now, European security, where Germany sits, relations with Donald Trump. How confident are you you can form a stable coalition and take a more of a leadership role in Europe?
I hope that we have in the Social Democrats, maybe under the leadership of Boris Pistorius, which is the defense minister in Germany now, that we have the chance to increase significantly our defense expenditures, maybe up to 3% or something like that, to make sure that the German Bundeswehr is the strongest pillar of NATO in Europe. I think we also should think about that German Bundeswehr should go doing more in the European NATO, maybe replacing some activities of the US. We want to have a close cooperation, also European Union defense policy together with UK and Norway, as we already do in Germany, Jürgen, for example, for building the submarines.
We have to wrap it up there, but thank you so much, Jürgen Hart from the CDU. We can talk now to Beatrix von Storck, MP with the AfD, Deputy Parliamentary Leader. Good evening.
Good evening.
What message do you think the German electorate has shown by giving your party what appear around a fifth of the vote?
Well, the signal from the German voters is very, very clear. The whole campaign was about mass migration, illegal mass migration, and it was about economy and energy supply. And on those both areas, AfD has a very, very clear program. And on that same area, the CDU was campaigning on. So they promised to their voters that the two main topics, migration and economy, they would basically they're basically supporting what AfD also wants. So if it comes to those two areas which we have to solve in the near future to save our country and to save our industry and to save lives, there is a very clear majority to really leave the track on which the last government, you know, was going. So, we voted in favor of changing the political direction of this country, and now the CDU is heading towards an Afghanistan coalition, which means black, red, and green. And so there's by no means a possibility for the next chancellor under
I'm just going to translate that. So that's the CDU with the Green Party and the Social Democrats, you're saying, is the most likely one. But not you. Your party's still out in the cold, despite coming second. Is there any conceivable way that you tear down this firewall?
I think this will be torn down by the people voting for the Christian Democrats, because they want to have first stop the illegal migration, keep the people out of Germany and send those back home from Syria, Afghanistan.
Just so I'm clear, you're saying that they've essentially adopted your clothes?
This is what the CDU was campaigning on, yes, and they promised to make our borders safe. And now in the Afghanistan coalition, together with the Social Democrats and the Greens, that's going to be impossible. So they can't deliver what they promised in the whole campaign. And so people will get desperate. And I think the new upcoming government will not last for 4 years. I think that's very unlikely that happens. And then we will have re-election maybe in 1 or 2 years.
And you think you're going to be in a stronger position then to take power? What's going to change?
Well, the situation of Germany is worsening by the day. And if the problems are not solved by the government, the opposition party will gain. And that's us. So we are 20% at the very moment. And we might end up with 30 plus or something if the government is not willing to change the direction of policy at the very moment. There is a majority of AfD and CDU. So if CDU was just being willing to table what they are promising, they don't even have to talk to us. They just can table what they were promising to the people, and then there will be a majority.
Beatrix von Storck from the AfD, thanks very much. More from Germany later on here on NewsHour.
Yes, and also still to come.
We have to do this very quickly. I mean, we started as the fires were still raging, and we have to remove the household hazardous materials so they actually don't impact the ocean.
More on the huge effort to clear up after the Los Angeles wildfires. Our top headlines this evening, as we've been hearing from Berlin, Friedrich Merz is in pole position to become Germany's next chancellor. As exit polls show, his centre-right grouping has won the general election. The far-right AfD appears to have come second. And Volodymyr Zelensky has told reporters he'd be willing to give up his presidency if it meant Ukraine could join NATO. You're with NewsHour live from the BBC with James Kamara-Sami in Berlin and me, Rebecca Kesby, in London. And Catholics and other Christians across the world have been holding Sunday prayers and vigils for Pope Francis, who continues to be treated for double pneumonia at Gemelli Hospital in Rome, where today supporters also gathered to say prayers.
Santa Maria, Madre di Dio, prega per noi. Grazie, il Signore è contigo, bendita tu eres entre todas las mujeres.
Well, earlier, a brief update from the Vatican said that the 88-year-old Pope had had a peaceful night, but that his condition was still considered critical. Medics have also said that it's a complex and delicate balance, and Pope Francis has also needed some blood transfusions for anemia. We can cross live now to Rome and the BBC's Sarah Rainsford, who joins us from St. Peter's Square at the Vatican. Sarah, what's the mood there tonight, and have we had any updates on the Pope's health?
Yeah, I'd say the mood is still somber. Still people very, very concerned about the Pope, of course. Perhaps a little relief today after the latest update. But that, I would say, is relative, because I think yesterday's news was so stark and so shocking for many people when they heard about what was described as a respiratory crisis that the Pope had suffered and the fact he'd had blood transfusions. Now, today we've been told by the Vatican that the Pope remains in a critical condition. So in that sense, nothing has changed. But they clarified that he had responded quite well to the blood transfusions that he had had. They said he was on oxygen. He was having oxygen administered through the nose. They said, though, that he had developed a mild kidney problem, a renal insufficiency, they called it, which they said for now was under control. But I think that's something certainly that is worrying his doctors and of course, those following this very, very closely around the world. So they're still underlining that this is a really complex picture. They say that they're holding back on giving a prognosis, but certainly it looks like the Pope is going to be in hospital for some time. We know he can talk. We know that he does occasionally make it to his armchair. And today, being Sunday, we are also told that he did go to Mass. Now, he should have been at Mass here at St. Peter's. He was supposed to be presiding over the Mass here, a big event, actually, this particular Mass in a Jubilee year for the Catholic Church. But instead, he went to a Mass in the chapel on the 10th floor of the hospital where he's being treated, just along the corridor, I understand, from where he is actually, you know, his hospital bed is located.
And Sarah, you mentioned how many people are there in Rome offering prayers, and the Pope sent a message today to well-wishers.
He did. He said that he was confident, relatively. So he was supposed to give usually gives on a Sunday an Angelus prayer and then a short address. But he couldn't do that this week, of course. He couldn't do it last week either. This time, the message was delivered in printed form. We're told the Pope wrote it himself, but that was written in the last few days. So clearly it hasn't been written in the last couple of days when his health has taken an obvious turn for the worse. But certainly it was a fairly upbeat message. But the Pope also saying that he was asking Catholics around the world to pray for him. You know, he said that he was going to be resting. That was, he said, part of the cure. Because one thing about the Pope is that he is not a man who's known for taking life easily. Mm. And in fact, he was working even on the day he was hospitalised. So I think rest is part of the cure.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you very much for that latest update from Rome. That's the BBC's Sarah Rainsford there. On the eve of the third anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, President Zelensky has told a press conference that he's willing to give up his presidency in exchange for peace. But he repeated his message that his country needed security assurances from the United States.
What I'd really like from Trump is mutual understanding and to hear about the security guarantees that Ukraine needs. This was partially mentioned in the Ukraine victory plan so that Ukraine would have a strong position at the negotiating table. Security guarantees from Trump is something that we really need.
Mr. Zelensky also said he was prepared to quit his job if it meant Ukraine could get NATO membership.
If there is peace for Ukraine, if you really need me to leave my post, then I am ready to do that for the sake of peace in Ukraine. I can exchange this for NATO membership if these are the conditions immediately. My focus is on the security of Ukraine today, not in 20 years. And I'm not going to be in power for decades.
Well, overnight, Russia launched its largest single drone attack on Ukraine since the beginning of the war 3 years ago. 138 drones were shot down, says the Ukrainian Air Force. Nearly 120 other drones, though, were also fired at around 13 regions across the country. Earlier, my colleague Julian Warwicker spoke to one young Ukrainian who signed up to join the army on day one of the war. Ivan is just 23 years old and is currently serving on the very dangerous Eastern Front.
I'm a soldier for 3 years right now. So I just got used to the position. I don't know how to describe it. Just a routine, just a job. I live actually underground. And eat everything that a normal human eats every day. I don't feel uncomfortable right now.
Which will surprise so many people, because here you are, so young, fighting for 3 years. You've just described having to live underground, yet you don't feel uncomfortable just now.
Yeah. I don't know what to say additionally.
But if I'd said to you when you were, say, 16 years old, this is what the next 5 years would be like, you wouldn't have begun to imagine that, would you?
Actually, I could imagine that, taking into consideration that the war started in 2014, and I had some thoughts that it may start again and that I'm going to take part in defending the country.
That's interesting. So even as a teenager, because of that first Russian action in 2014 in Crimea and the East, before the full-scale invasion 3 years ago, you were already beginning to think you might have to serve your country?
Yeah, it's not because of a big wish, but I needed to do this because else my house would be destroyed. My family could possibly be killed, so I had no other way.
And you remain as determined as ever to continue, by the sounds of it.
Maybe not as at the beginning. I'm tired, like most of the people here, but we have no other way.
What about the politics of this? I was thinking, for example, of the impact that the phone conversation between President Trump and President Putin has had on you and others around you.
I think that America's got its own interests in how this war must end. There is a big possibility that the American aid can stop. Well, we'll try to fight without it. It's going to be hard, but what else do we have to do?
And that's the voice of one Ukrainian soldier, Ivan, speaking to Julian Warwicker from the front line there in Ukraine. Welcome back to NewsHour. The wildfires that ripped through Los Angeles last month have left at least 29 people dead and destroyed more than 16,000 homes and businesses. The cleanup is well underway, but sorting through and disposing of millions of tons of debris is a major logistical challenge. The governor of California, Gavin Newsom, is asking Congress now for $40 billion to help the city recover and rebuild. Regan Morris sent this report from Los Angeles.
Will Rogers State Beach is one of the most recognizable stretches of sand in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks to the global cult classic Baywatch. But now the iconic beach is barely recognizable. Surrounded by the ruins of burned homes and palm trees, the parking lot is a sorting ground for hazardous waste from the wildfires. The beach babes have been replaced by Environmental Protection Agency crews in hazmat suits. The decision to sort through hazardous waste along the coast has prompted protests.
Sort the hazardous waste in its place. Sort the hazardous waste in its place.
it just seems absolutely absurd to us to put something next to a flowing creek.
Actor Bonnie Wright, who played Ginny Weasley in the Harry Potter films and has written a book on sustainability, has been lobbying officials to protect sensitive waterways near her neighborhood in Topanga Canyon.
There's a lot of tourism on the coastline. There's a lot of industry that comes because of this beautiful coastline we have, but it won't really be beautiful if we have fire hazardous waste running off the land and into the ocean.
Steve Kalinog is the EPA's incident commander for the LA fires.
We have to do this very quickly. I mean, we started as the fires were still raging, and we have to remove the household hazardous materials so they actually don't impact the ocean. If we are delayed, the risk of impacting the ocean goes up. We're the United States Environmental Protection Agencies. We're the nation's experts in handling hazardous materials, and we're able to do it safely without incident.
What about all those Teslas and electric cars that were incinerated? Where do they go?
When lithium-ion batteries are damaged by high heat and flames, they have the potential for reigniting and exploding days, weeks, months after they've been impacted. So we have to treat them like unexploded ordnance. We have to process them so they can be transported safely to a recycling or disposal facility.
LA County closed beaches along a 14-kilometer stretch for weeks following the fires in January. Torrential rain, which helped douse smoldering embers, caused mudslides in the burn area and runoff of toxic ash and chemicals into the ocean. Now most beaches are reopened, but an advisory remains in effect along the coast from Santa Monica to Malibu, urging people to stay out of the water until further notice.
And that's the BBC's Regan Morris with that report on the cleanup and huge rebuilding job ahead for people there in Los Angeles after those devastating wildfires in January.
You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live with Rebecca Kesby in London and with me, James Kamara-Sami, in Berlin, where we are digesting the still incomplete results of Germany's general election, which has delivered a clear victory, nevertheless, to Friedrich Merz of the Conservative Christian Democrats. Well, until the final results are in, we will not know how many parties have crossed the 5% threshold needed to enter parliament. And that means that the options open to the next German chancellor are still not clear. What is clear, though, and has been all along, frankly, is his party will not be entering into coalition with the far-right AfD, even though they have finished second with around a fifth of the vote. We can speak to our correspondent, Nick Beek, who's at the AfD headquarters. Nick, what's the mood been like there tonight?
Hi, James. Well, it's the calm after the storm here. What you can hear in the background are lots of people de-rigging and basically putting all their equipment away because the party is over. But it was quite a party because from the moment that on the big screen here people saw the projection of the AfD vote, which as you said, around 20%, was an historic high and crucially was a doubling of their share of the vote compared with the last general election. So people were really ecstatic here when their co-leader came onto the stage. People were, you know, whooping, cheering. But as you've been pointing out, ultimately, people here tonight know that they won't be part of a coalition. And they have really lambasted that. They say that it's democratically unfair that millions of Germans are having their voices ignored because they're not being allowed into the coalition building process.
Nick, I'm going to let you go because it almost feels though you're about to be packed up and stashed away. But thanks for that update from the AfD headquarters. Instead, we can talk to Hayo Funke, political scientist and expert on the far right here. And you've studied the far right for some time, Hayo, haven't you? What would you say about tonight's result as far as the AfD is concerned?
AfD has had a big success, but it's only 20.
So the only 20, that's double
only
the previous.
20, because they expected more, and they have a threshold in the German population consciousness. They don't the German majority of 75% to 80%, according to surveys, don't want to have right-wing extremist, clear racist party in power.
How can you be so sure they've reached their ceiling when they have advanced considerably from the last general election?
This is because three factors were against the democratic parties, especially the ample coalition parties. They didn't do a good job. Furthermore, there is a multifaceted crisis in economics, in inflation, and having still the Ukrainian war. And so we have an influx from migrants. And the AfD is using this migrant issue as a kind of scapegoat that is responsible to their statement for all the problems we have. And they want to have a different country. They are clear-cut, racist, right-wing revolutionary party.
Well,
this is the reason why they won't have a coalition.
I come back to the point that more and more Germans are voting for them, even if you think they have almost reached the ceiling. And given that the other parties are doing worse than them, can they realistically be kept out of power, even if they are continuing to be second?
Yes, you know, it's on the one hand we have democratic votes and they have a say in the elections. On the other hand, there are, you know, perceptions in the democratic parties not to cooperate with the undemocratic party, and this is an undemocratic party, although chosen by the electorate.
Well, that's the catch-22, isn't it? They have been democratically given 20%, around 20% of the vote.
Yes.
So clearly Germans, and perhaps more younger Germans, it would seem, have been deciding that they want them as someone who is not of the establishment.
Yes, but this goes to that party or to that party. 90%, according to this election, are, you know, from the youngest grouping are voting for the AfD. So it's the average of those who are voting for the AfD. It's not more. Quite the contrary. Now, in this election, 27% went to a democratic left party, the leftist, because of social issues and because of fighting against the racism of the AfD.
Heiko Funke, expert on the far right. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. We can talk now to an MP from the Social Democrats, Armand Zorn, who represents Frankfurt am Main's District Number 1, joins us from Frankfurt. Good evening.
Good evening.
Do you know at the moment how you have done? Because your party has done historically badly.
Yes, no, we're still currently waiting for the final result in Frankfurt. It's a close race. I think currently the CDU candidate is in front with about 0.1%. So it's going to be a long night until we have the final results.
The outgoing chancellor, your candidate for chancellor, Olaf Scholz, acknowledged that this was a bitter result. Would it have been less bitter, do you think, if he had stepped down and allowed someone else to run in his place?
I think it's hard to say. We don't know, and we're never going to know. But I think when you're looking at what's going on across the globe, you can see that incumbent governments have a really challenge staying in power. It happened in the US, in the UK, in France, in Europe, and also in Germany as well. So I think with all the crisis going on and all the challenges we're currently facing, it's quite difficult for incumbent governments to get re-elected, and unfortunately the same thing happened to us tonight and to Chancellor Olaf Scholz.
Of course, despite that, despite, as I mentioned, the party's worst performance since World War II, there is every chance you will be in a coalition with the Christian Democrats at the head of it. I mean, the discussions presumably are going to be quite complicated, even if Friedrich Merz wants them to be over quickly. What are the red lines, do you think, going to be for your party about entering into a coalition?
I think first we need to see the final composition of the parliament. I think we're still debating or still waiting if BSW or FDP are going to be part of the parliament. Are we going to need a three-party coalition or a two-party coalition? I think these things are quite crucial to know the entire setup we're talking about. And then we're going to have to discuss about certain topics. I think it's quite clear that we need to do something about the economy. I think everyone agrees on that. I think my political party has made some proposals how we can support the people, how we can support low-income a household in Germany as well. And then when you're looking at other sectors such as infrastructure, education, migration, there's a lot of things to do. So it's quite difficult tonight to draw a red line. But I believe that if we happen to have to jump into negotiation, it's quite important that at the end of the day, the people who voted for the SPD and the people who put their hopes in the hands of the SPD, and also people that are disappointed with regards to the FDP, to the SPD, that they also see certain policy proposals happening.
Briefly, what does the success of the AfD tell you?
Well, I think it shows in what times we're currently living. I mean, and I think we also need to look at it from the European and also global perspective. You know, we are facing multiple crises, and unfortunately, in such a time, there have always been certain far-right and populist parties trying to play with the feelings and emotions of the voters. And the same things happened to us in Germany, where we're seeing a political party trying to work on that. And unfortunately, tonight they reached 20%. I think it's going to be a big challenge, and I think it's unfortunately going to stay for a while. But we need to work on that and get these people back.
Armin Zong, MP from the SPD, thank you very much indeed. Well, let's get a little bit of analysis. Joining us now, Ruth Kirschner, political correspondent with German ARD Radio. Good evening, Ruth. What do you make of what you've been hearing over the last few hours?
Well, I think German politics is entering a sort of fairly tricky stage after this election night, because despite what Friedrich Merz, the CDU leader, is saying, that he's sort of aiming for short coalition talks, it might be actually quite difficult to form a government. I mean, we can say with some certainty that he's probably going to be the next chancellor leading Germany for the next few years. But we still don't know what kind of coalition he'll be able to form, and a lot of hinges on that.
And a lot of people in Europe and beyond are going to be asking what that means then for Germany's role at this key moment in history where Donald Trump has upended all the certainties of European security. Will Friedrich Merz be able to put his stamp on Germany both inside the country and internationally in the short term?
Well, that is really the big question, and we don't know at this stage. I mean, he has said in the past that, you know, he wants to start working sort of from day one after the election, but our system is not designed in a way that he can just take the reins and start sort of implementing his own policies. What we're going to see is our sort of coalition talks, or first some exploratory talks with parties that might or might not want to enter into a coalition with the CDU and the Bavarian sister party, CSU. Then there will be, presumably, a lot of discussion about the nitty-gritty, about where, for instance, because you mentioned foreign and security policy, where extra funding for defense spending should come from. The CDU foreign policy person you had on the program earlier was talking about 3% of GDP on for defense. Well, the question is, where do you cut back to free up money for increased defense spending? And especially if Friedrich Merz enters a coalition with the SPD, which looks most likely, maybe with a third party, maybe just the two parties, then he will have very difficult talks ahead with the Social Democrats, who have been more cautious on defense, and also who will be very keen on not cutting back on this on the welfare state and on social spending.
Yeah, and briefly, just to turn to the AfD, we had a senior member of that party on earlier who was basically saying, look, this new coalition is going to be unstable again, and you know, we will sweep in. Where do you think this leaves them?
Well, I think the AfD, at this point in time, there is no way that any of the other parties wants any sort of closer cooperation with the AfD, and I think we probably can take Friedrich Merz's words that he's not going to enter in any talks with the AfD. But a three-party coalition, that, or even a two-party coalition, how stable is that going to be? And I think the AfD has clearly set its sight on the next election in 4 years if the new government holds for four years.
Well, quite. This has been a snap election. We will see. Ruth, many thanks for that analysis. Ruth Kirschner, political correspondent with German ARD Radio. So, a victory for the Christian Democrats, but still uncertainty about the shape and the colours of the new coalition government. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service with Rebecca Kesby and James Kamarasamy here in Berlin.
You're with NewsHour live from the BBC with James Kamarasamy in Berlin and me, Rebecca Kesby, in London. In the latest move to slash US government spending, tech billionaire and head of the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, Elon Musk, has written an email to thousands of federal workers instructing them to list what they got done last week by noon on Monday. Failure to submit a list of individual achievements would, he said, be taken as a resignation. The emails dropped on Saturday afternoon from a new HR account and were sent with high importance exclamation marks. But already some government agencies, including the State Department and the FBI, have instructed their staff not to reply to the email. The move has caused shock and some panic among federal workers, tens of thousands of whom have already lost their jobs. Well, last night at the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, in Maryland, President Trump had nothing but praise for Elon Musk's initiatives.
I signed an order creating the Department of Government Efficiency. You probably haven't heard of it, which is now waging war on government waste, fraud, and abuse. And Elon is doing a great job. He's doing a great job.
Well, I've been speaking to Sam Begenstoss, who's professor of law at the University of Michigan and, until a couple of months ago, legal counsel to the Department of Health and Human Services. So first, is this approach to laying off workers even legal?
No, it really isn't. You know, there is a very precise, carefully constructed administrative process for disciplining, supervising, and terminating employees in the federal government. We're talking about career civil service employees who have substantial protections to enable them to do their work without political interference. And what Elon Musk is doing is just inconsistent with all of those protections.
Well, there has been some challenges to previous layoffs already. And then today we hear that the FBI new director, this is Kash Patel, he's a Trump appointee, and he's advising workers at the FBI not to reply to this email. What would your advice be to employees? I mean, it all sounds quite confusing for them.
You know, the employees need to be consulting with the unions that represent them and with personal lawyers if necessary. A number of the unions have said don't respond to this. And we've seen a number, as you say, of Trump-appointed heads of these agencies say, hold up for a second, we're not so sure you should be responding to this email that Elon Musk had sent to you. You know, I think that's just a sign, again, of how legally unsupportable this all is.
But thousands of people have already been told that their contracts are terminated. I mean, are you hearing from federal employees who have just been told they're losing their jobs? And will there be some sort of legal action from them?
Yes. I mean, so this is part of a much bigger campaign that Elon Musk and Donald Trump are waging against career government civil servants. I'm a former general counsel at the Department of Health and Human Services, and I heard from a number of my former staff last weekend that they had been fired. And I think this email, that's just yet another element in a campaign designed to terrorize career government civil servants, to make them feel like it's not worth it to stay on the job and to get them to leave. Now, you asked about legal challenges. There have been a number of legal challenges already. A number of them are pending in court. You know, the Trump administration has been firing civil servants, but also firing the people who work within the government whose job is to protect civil servants' rights. And there are challenges to those firings in court as well.
So Mr. Musk obviously says he's just trying to save the government money, that there's a lot of inefficiency in government departments, and he's just trying to streamline the system. And he says that that will benefit all Americans. But are the severe workforce cuts already having an impact on the functioning of some of these government departments?
They're having a huge impact on the functioning of government departments. You know, I talk to folks who run childcare programs that are funded by the government and are unable to access the funding and oversight they need to continue operations. We have had clinical trials being shut down. We have a major problem in this country of air traffic control safety, and they're firing air traffic controllers and the people who supervise them. This is not about saving money. The budgetary savings are really minuscule compared to the federal budget. This is about absolutely decimating the federal administrative structure, the structure of civil service on which people rely for the functions of government.
But hasn't Mr. Musk got a point that there is room for some efficiencies? And how could he be going about this in a way that wouldn't cause this level of panic and upset as you're describing?
If it were about inefficiencies, he wouldn't be doing anything like what he's doing, which is just both indiscriminate cuts and refusals to spend money that Congress has specifically appropriated, and these massive firings across the federal government, often firings of people not only who have been doing good work, but who are performing essential functions for the government. If this had anything to do with government waste, what you would be doing is trying to identify, well, what are the things government is doing that they really shouldn't be doing? Or what are the things that we are doing inefficiently? Musk is making no effort to do any of that. He's just going out and cutting beyond the bone on really essential functions. And often it seems to be targeted on these sort of ideological hobby horses of Donald Trump and Elon Musk. So cutting government aid or cutting aid to people in other countries, where we're talking about providing healthcare services to prevent infectious diseases that not only harm people in other countries, but can pose a risk to the United States as well. That's all about an ideological obsession that we shouldn't be doing anything that helps other countries. And I could go down the list like that.
I mean, we are now talking about thousands of people losing their jobs, potentially tens of thousands. Could this end up being actually quite politically costly for Donald Trump and Republicans generally?
I think we are already starting to see political blowback on Donald Trump and Republicans. So over the past week, members of Congress were home in their districts. A lot of them were having town hall meetings with their constituents. And the Republican members of Congress across the country, I mean, these are, in again, Republican districts, were swamped with people yelling at them at these town hall meetings, saying, what is going on here? Why are you cutting these essential government services that we all rely on? You know, again, these are Republican Trump supporting districts, and even there we're seeing very significant blowback.
Professor Sam Bagenstos there from the University of Michigan, bringing us to an end to this edition from the team in Berlin and here in London. Thanks for joining us.